Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point. In the history of American spycraft, Edward Lansdale plays a leading role. He was a mid-20th century advertising executive turned intelligence operative who strongly influenced early American policy toward Vietnam. But his influence shrank as the war expanded and went wrong. My guest today, historian Max Boot, argues in a new book that may have been part of the problem. Could Lansdale's strategy of fighting guerrilla war by winning hearts and minds, popular lately with U.S. generals in Iraq and Afghanistan, have produced a better outcome in Southeast Asia? This hour on Point, the story of Edward Lansdale and what it means for America today. Joining me now from Washington is historian Max Boot. He's a senior fellow for national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book, which follows two earlier ones on U.S. involvement in civil wars abroad, is The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Experience in Vietnam. It's already a New York Times bestseller. For an excerpt of the book, go to our website on onpointradio.org. Max Boot, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, John.
Max, let me just start, before I get to Lansdale, with a moment about you and this topic. I think people who consume political media today, this year, know you as a conservative editorialist who turned into a leading voice against Trump among conservative intellectuals. Tell me how you got to the subject of Edward Lansdale. Any connection with the evolution of your views on this president, or where did it come from?
Well, I started working on Ed Lansdale in 2013 when nobody had any idea, of course, that Donald Trump could possibly become president of the United States. And there's no direct connection, although in some ways, in hindsight, what I can see now is that Ed Lansdale was in some ways the anti-Trump, because he was somebody who believed in engaging in the world with empathy and understanding and treating others as equals and with dignity and respect, all these things that are pretty much the opposite of what Donald Trump does. But I got interested in Lansdale after having written about him a little bit in my last book on the history of guerrilla warfare, and my editor urged me to make that into a full book, and I was initially skeptical of doing that, but in fact, he was dead right, because I have discovered a mass of new material about Ed Lansdale, who was this legendary figure. He was said to be the model for the quiet American and the ugly American. He was written about by David Halberstam and Neil Sheehan and pretty much every author on Vietnam, and yet there is still so much we don't know about him, and I was very lucky in the course of my book research to get my hands on the secret love letters that he wrote to this extraordinary Filipino woman named Pat Kelly, who was his longtime lover and eventually his second wife. I also got my hands on the letters that he wrote often simultaneously to his first wife, Helen, and then I was also the beneficiary of a lot of newly declassified CIA documents. So as a result of all that, I'm able to tell the Ed Lansdale story in a way that it's never been told before.
And Max, I think you've got fortuitous timing in one small sense in popular culture. The new movie, The Post, about the Washington Post and the Pentagon Papers, begins with a scene with Daniel Ellsberg, who was the eventual leaker of the Pentagon Papers, in combat in Vietnam. And he's identified as somebody attached to a unit led by Edward Lansdale.
Yes, I was tickled pink to see that movie. It was a good movie, but the very first spoken lines were one Marine saying to another, "Who's the long hair?" And the answer is, "That's Ellsberg. He works for Lansdale at the embassy." And that's, in fact, a completely accurate, because Dan Ellsberg, who was a former RAND analyst, went over to Vietnam in 1965, in fact, to work for Ed Lansdale when Lansdale was a senior counselor at the embassy. And they actually maintained good relations. And I interviewed Dan Ellsberg for this book, and what he told me was, "I loved Ed Lansdale," and he loves him still. He has tremendous respect for him, even though Ellsberg turned against the war, and Lansdale remained in some ways a supporter, although he was neither a conventional hawk nor dove, because He disagreed with the Doves that we should simply abandon South Vietnam, but he disagreed with the Hawks, who thought that we could bomb the Viet Cong into submission. So Lansdale occupied this interesting place on the political spectrum where he had great relations with somebody like Dan Ellsberg.
Now, as we get into this discussion, I want to give our viewers a listen to Ed Lansdale's voice in real life in a clip that I think is reflective of his philosophy and the way he thought about engaging with people in the countries that the United States was involved with. This is from a 1979 interview with journalist Stanley Karnow. Lansdale offered some insight into his relationship with Vietnamese President Diem. Diem had gone out into the countryside and taken photographs of peasants he met, and he's showing them to Lansdale, and Lansdale tells Diem what he thought.
I said, well, shame on you. You've got these farmers out in the fields taking off their hats, and you're talking down to them. And you can't get the truth from a man whose eyes you can't see and who you aren't looking in his face and having a really man-to-man conversation. So tell them to keep their hats on and talk to them. When you start showing me pictures of you doing that, I'll think that you start learning what your own people want, and you'll be getting the truth from them.
Max Boot, tell us what that reveals about Ed Lansdale's philosophy, and talk a little bit about when he started to implement that, not just in Vietnam, but in the Philippines before that.
That's a quote that really sums up the Lansdale approach to counterinsurgency, which is to treat people as brothers, to treat them as equals, to treat them with dignity and respect. And you have to understand how extraordinary this was for an American of his time in the 40s and 50s. I mean, remember, he was born in 1908. He grew up in California in the 1920s when there was rampant prejudice against Asians. There were all sorts of sinister theories about Chinese Americans and so forth and so on. And Lansdale was never infected by that kind of racism. He always saw people as his equals in dignity and in worth.
Would you describe him as a progressive?
Absolutely, yeah. He was somebody who had, I think, very progressive racial attitudes. I mean, reading his correspondence and everything that he wrote, which is still surviving, I didn't see a single racial epithet. I didn't see any kind of slurs of the kind that were very common, even for fairly enlightened people in the 1930s and 40s. And so when he went over to the Philippines for the first time in 1945, deployed there on behalf of the Army and eventually on behalf of the CIA, he kind of plunged into society. He was fascinated by everything he met, and he treated Filipinos as his friends. He made friends wherever he went. He was really somebody who, I think, turned empathy into a powerful tool of American national policy, because he won people over, including very powerful people like Ramon Magsaysay, who became the defense minister in the Philippines and eventually, with Lansdale's help, was elected president. And then in Vietnam, to get back to his quote about No Dinh Diem, he also won Diem over, even though he literally did not speak Diem's language, because Lansdale spoke English and Diem spoke French and Vietnamese, and they communicated through a translator. But nevertheless,
Lansdale was not one of these spies who had a whole bunch of language training.
That was one of his weaknesses. He was never proud of that. But it's all the more extraordinary that he was able to forge these very deep and close connections with people, even when he literally didn't speak their language, because he was just naturally a friendly person. And the secret of his success, very simple, was that he listened rather than lectured. Americans love to go to the developing world and tell people what to do and lecture them and look down upon them. And he didn't do any of that. He would actually listen. And with somebody like Diem, that was not easy to do, because Diem became notorious for his multi-hour monologues that bored other Americans stiff. But Ed Lansdale was made of sterner stuff and probably had a stronger bladder. And he would sit there for hours listening to Diem drone on. And then he would say, that's fascinating. If I understand what you're saying X, Y, and Z. And then he would subtly rephrase what Diem had been saying to impart his own thoughts as if they were Diem's own.
Now, Max, you referred a minute ago to secret of Lansdale's success. What would you point to and say, this is where he succeeded for the United States, for American foreign policy?
Well, the making of the Lansdale legend really began in the Philippines in 1950 when he was on his second tour there, this time on behalf of the CIA, at a time when there was widespread fear in Washington that the Philippines was about to go communist because of the Hook insurgency, the communists in the Philippines. And instead of deploying thousands of American combat troops, Washington sent Ed Lansdale and a few other helpers to work in secret with Filipinos like Ramon Magsaysay, the defense minister, to mastermind the defeat of the Hook rebellion. And in the process of doing that, Lansdale pioneered what would become known as counterinsurgency doctrine, this notion that you're not going to defeat the insurgents simply by killing them. You have to offer a better idea. You have to offer a positive alternative, a government that the people will support, because if you're just going out there and bombarding villages, you're creating more enemies than you're eliminating.
And did that early success in the Philippines give him cachet throughout the government, the Eisenhower administration at that time?
Oh, yes. I mean, this was one of the signal U.S. Successes in the early Cold War. And as a result of this success in the Philippines, when policymakers in Washington were looking at Vietnam in 1954, when that country was divided into communist North Vietnam and to non-communist South Vietnam, and they were wondering how on earth are we going to create a viable non-communist state in the South, they naturally thought of Ed Lansdale. And so he was sent out there right after the fall of Dien Bien Phu in the summer of 1954. And his orders from Alan Dulles, the CIA director, were literally, do what you did in the Philippines. And he basically did.
Later, his influence, of course, waned, which we'll talk about in the next segment. But how long was he there in that first tour of duty in Vietnam?
He was there for about 2.5 years, up until the end of 1956. And he achieved a lot more than anybody expected, because when Ngo Dinh Diem was appointed prime minister of this new state of South Vietnam in the summer of 1954, few people thought that he would last 9 weeks, much less 9 years. And the fact that he consolidated power was due in large part to the secret role played by Ed Lansdale.
Max Boot, stay right there. We're looking at the life of Edward Lansdale, an American-style Lawrence of Arabia in the years following World War II. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA, the podcast that takes you inside the Latino conversation. Each week, we'll take you into one story that will fascinate and often surprise you. Listen to Latino USA on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. I'm talking with historian Max Boot about his new book, The Road Not Taken: Edward Lansdale and the American Experience in Vietnam. Max Boot is my guest today. He's a senior fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the new book, The Road Not Taken: Edward Lansdale and the American Experience in Vietnam. It's a New York Times bestseller already. We have an excerpt of his book on our website, onpointradio.org. Now, Max, you were saying before the break that he had a lot of cachet within the American government, but your book traces the change in that when he ultimately came to be regarded as a bit of a crank whose advice wasn't welcome. I want to play one clip of the United States President Lyndon Johnson in 1965 announcing a major troop surge to Vietnam after 11 years of war between the two countries, and we can talk about whether this was the point where he began to lose influence.
I have today ordered to Vietnam the Air Mobile Division and certain other forces which will raise our fighting strength from 75,000 to 125,000 men almost immediately. Additional forces will be needed later, and they will be sent as requested.
Max, was the moment when the U.S. government scaled up the war dramatically the moment when they decided that what Ed Lansdale was talking about was too small bore to be successful?
I think it actually occurred earlier than that. I think the turning point was really 1963, when you had the military coup in South Vietnam that overthrew Ngo Dinh Diem. That was in many ways the pivot point in the Vietnam War, because prior to that, We had a bunch of advisors in Vietnam, but American troops were not, by and large, in leading the actual combat operations. But after you had the Diem coup, stability in South Vietnam all but collapsed. One coup succeeded another, one general after another. And that's what led to the decision by Lyndon Johnson in 1965 to commit American combat troops, which was something that Lansdale opposed. But Lansdale critically opposed the Diem coup. And that's where I begin my book with that coup, because I think it was so important. And the fact that Lansdale's advice was ignored, because he predicted just how catastrophic this coup would be. He said, I know the generals who want to succeed Diem. And yeah, Diem has his problems, but these generals are less legitimate, less honest, less effective. It's going to be a catastrophe. And unfortunately, he was ignored by Henry Cabot Lodge, the ambassador in Saigon, and by the rest of the best and brightest in the Kennedy administration.
How much responsibility do you assign for that coup to Lodge? And you noted in your book that he loved the idea of being a kingmaker when he was sent to Vietnam by John F. Kennedy. And how much responsibility goes to John F. Kennedy himself, who, of course, was leading the government?
Well, ultimately, the buck stops in the Oval Office, and President Kennedy could have turned off the coup, and he chose not to. There's no question that Henry Cabot Lodge was an enthusiastic proponent of overthrowing Diem, even though he knew virtually nothing about South Vietnam. And this was a problem that Lansdale encountered time again with people not just like Henry Cabot Lodge, but also his boss at the Pentagon at the time, Robert McNamara, where, you know, Lansdale tried to explain the realities of South Vietnam. In fact, when he met McNamara in early 1961, he came into his office with a bunch of weapons that had just been liberated from the Viet Cong, and Lansdale had just been in Vietnam, and he dumped these dirty, rusty, mud-covered weapons, very simple muskets and spears and so forth, on McNamara's desk and said, you know, Mr. Secretary, these are the weapons that are being used by our enemies. And you wouldn't think of them as soldiers in our sense. They wear black pajamas. They have very primitive weapons. But they are actually licking our side because they have the power of an idea, the power of an ideal. And the only way we're going to defeat them is if we have an ideal of our own to offer the people of South Vietnam. We're not going to bomb this revolution into submission.
Did his theory ever have a chance after the coup to actually be put to the test?
That's a great question. And, you know, Lansdale certainly tried to implement some of his ideas when he went back to Vietnam on another tour from 1965 to 1968, working initially for the aforementioned Henry Cabot Lodge. He certainly tried to fight corruption and sectarianism within South Vietnam. He had very limited success in holding one relatively fair election, but there was very little interest in what he was doing among the powers that be within the Lyndon Johnson administration, because General William Westmoreland was telling them that he could kill the insurgents faster than they could be replaced. And Lansdale understood this was foolish. It was never going to work, but people weren't listening to him, and they didn't understand, as he did, the importance of creating a stable, legitimate state in Saigon that could win the allegiance of its people, because, you know, the U.S. military and political establishment was just focused on military action, and Lansdale understood that was inadequate, but he was sidelined as, you know, we had put in half a million troops with their search and destroy missions and free fire zones and all the civilian casualties, all these horrors of war that Lansdale denounced.
I want to go to the phones. We've got Michael on the line from Arlington, Massachusetts. Michael, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead with Max Boot.
Okay. I spent two back-to-back tours in swift boats in Vietnam. And before we went to Vietnam, the Navy thoroughly educated us in counterinsurgencies. We studied everything from very early ones like the guerrilla war, which means little war, guerrilla, with the Spanish people against the French occupation of Napoleon, to what the Brits did in Malaysia, to what the Germans were successful at in Eastern Europe, and, of course, Colonel Lansdale, and I believe, oddly enough, he was an Air Force general, and President Magsaysay in the Philippines. And we were taught all through these that Lansdale's success was the model that should be followed in Vietnam. If there was a doctrine in swift boats in our training in Coronado Island, it was that. And I got there. Well, I was originally on the beach in 1965 March of 1965, when the Marines first landed. That was our big troop movement into Vietnam, that action. Then I went back there for these two combat tours with Swifts, and we did not wage anything like Colonel Lansdale's, or he ended up General Lansdale's.
Why not?
Model. We did just the opposite, because we wanted fast numbers. And therefore, we, as your guest just said, we believed that we could kill them faster than they could replace them, which shows the incredible ignorance that the Kennedy administration, you got to read the best and the brightest.
Michael, you think that Ed Lansdale had it right?
Absolutely right. But instead of doing what he did, now, Army lawyers in the Philippines actually brought actions against landowners that were exploiting their tenant farmers. That's how far they went to wage that revolution. And that's what should have been done in Vietnam. Instead, we supported corrupt after corrupt after corrupt official. And you got to read not the best and the brightest, Dereliction of Duty, to really understand how everybody lied to everybody. They lied to the president, Lyndon Johnson, and he lied to the people. And the uniformed commands in the Joint Chiefs lie to everybody.
Michael, thanks for your call, and thanks for your service to our country. I want to get Max Boot to respond. There you have a testimonial to the thesis of your book.
That Michael makes are dead right, and he is absolutely correct about the fact that a lot of people did learn the proper way to fight counterinsurgency in Vietnam based on the lessons of Ed Lansdale and others. But sadly, those lessons were not implemented. And as he was completely correct that the military high command, General William Westmoreland and everybody else, they basically wanted body counts. They thought that's how they were going to win the war. They would have these metrics of success, and the primary metric was how many Viet Cong they killed, rather than their success in establishing a stable government in Vietnam that could actually defend itself, which is what Ed Lansdale wanted to do. And it's truly a tragedy of history that this advice was disregarded, because if he had been listened to, things might have worked out very differently.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Christian on the line from Lexington, Kentucky. Christian, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hey, thank you, John. Great show today, Max. A pleasure to speak with you. Question for you. Ed Lansdale had studied advertising as a university student, and his first job was, I understand, in the advertising business. Do you think that at a fundamental level, he was just the wrong tool in a much bigger machine in the wrong war? Ho Chi Minh, what I mean by that is Ho Chi Minh had reached out when Japan was occupying Vietnam during World War II, had reached out to Roosevelt and Truman begging for U.S. aid, and the OSS had, you know, identified him as somebody that we as a nation should help, but we decided as a nation not to do that. And then Ed Lansdale just had an impossible job in front of him that nobody could win. So that's my question and just one comment. The only time my father was in the military, he was a soldier of the year in the U.S. Army. Not deployed in Vietnam, but stateside. And the only time I ever saw him cry, break down and cry, was in front of the Vietnam Memorial. That's my question. Thank you.
Christian, thanks so much. Max?
Well, there's no way to know if Ed Lansdale could possibly have been successful in Vietnam. I mean, he did have some success in the mid-50s in creating a stable, non-communist state of South Vietnam. And when he left South Vietnam at the end of 1956, Ngo Dinh Diem was seen as this great Cold War success story. He was given a ticker tape parade on Broadway, addressed a joint session of Congress. And so there was a feeling that South Vietnam was a going concern. But then after Lansdale left, things went south, and in part because Ngo Dinh Diem didn't have anybody around anymore to restrain his more autocratic impulses, and of course that led eventually to the confrontation with Washington, the military coup, the overthrow of Diem, the disintegration of South Vietnam, and eventually, as we were discussing, the commitment of 500,000 American combat troops. And by that point, of course, his advice was disregarded. Now, what might have been worked out differently if he had been listened to all along? Well, I certainly can't sit here and promise you that everything would have been perfect and we would have won the war in South Vietnam would still exist. There's just no way to know. But one thing that I can say for sure is that we would, even if we had still lost, it would not have been a catastrophe on the scale of what we actually suffered. We would not have lost 58,000 Americans in the jungles of Vietnam and millions of Vietnamese killed in the crossfire, because Ed Lansdale never wanted to see that kind of massive American military commitment. He did want to defend South Vietnam, but he wanted South Vietnamese to take responsibility for defending their own country.
Let's go back to the phones. Frank's on the line from Mount Vernon, Kentucky. Frank, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. Hello, Max. I would like to ask you if, Ed Lansdale was a very principled, morally ethical man. I would like for you, if you would, to speak descriptively about what you know about his religious training, and I'll listen online.
Max, you don't often hear people refer to former CIA operatives as principled moral men, not to say that they aren't, but that's not how in popular imagination we think of them. But talk about Lansdale from that perspective and whether he was a religious man as well.
Lansdale, I think those descriptions actually apply to Lansdale. He was a very unusual CIA operative and a very unusual military officer, one of the more unusual generals in the history of the Air Force. And his religion actually played an important part in his upbringing. And this is something that has not previously been known about him, the fact that his family were actually Christian Scientists. So he grew up in the Christian Science faith, and part of that, of
course, as did Daniel Ellsberg, am I right?
That is correct, yeah. That actually gave him some commonality. Even though both men, you know, drifted away from that religion in later life, nevertheless, I think what I detected in my study of Lansdale's upbringing is that the Christian Science faith did have an influence, because he was always an idealist. He believed in the power of ideals to transform societies like the Philippines and Vietnam. And I think part of that was rooted in the Christian Science faith, which puts mind over matter. And I think the faith was also important to him in another respect, because, of course, when he was a Christian Scientist, Christian Science was a tiny, embattled minority religion that was criticized by the mainstream of society. And so even though Lansdale grew up as a white middle-class American in California in the 1920s, nevertheless, he had an association with outsiders. He was a religious minority, and that gave him, I think, great empathy for other minorities like Asian Americans who were discriminated against at the time.
Max, how did Ed Lansdale handle it when he started not to be listened to? What did he do?
He became very frustrated. He really seethed in private. He tried to keep a brave face in public. And, you know, this is the reason why a lot of the correspondents who dealt with him in the 1960s, like Halberstam and Sheen and so forth, thought that he was kind of the simplistic, gung-ho American who was always rah-rah and we're going to win. And that was, you know, he thought it was important for morale purposes to keep up that brave front in public. But in private, it was a very different story. As Dan Ellsberg told me, you know, in private, he was a very shrewd analyst who understood fully the weaknesses of our side. And that I can confirm that, having read his private correspondence that nobody else has had access to. He was very, very pessimistic from the moment he arrived in Vietnam in 1965. He saw that the war was being lost, that our side
had
a
passage in your book where you had somebody confiding to someone else that he was a lot less rah-rah in private than he was in public.
Right. I think that was Dan Ellsberg, in fact, saying that, he was actually a very sophisticated analyst who understood much better than the other policymakers in Saigon and Washington how badly the war effort was going. He understood that the so-called progress claimed by people like General Westmoreland was specious, that this was an illusion. And so, you know, he was less surprised than many of the others by the Tet Offensive, which occurred 50 years ago this month, because he understood that there was actually no light at the end of the tunnel, that Westmoreland was selling a bill of goods to the American public.
How long did he remain in Vietnam after his influence was essentially cut off?
Well, he had little influence in his second tour from 1965 until the summer of 68. He was there for the Tet Offensive and left a dejected, defeated, and demoralized man.
Max Boot, stay right there. We're talking about what Cold War warrior and spy Edward Lansdale can teach us about right and wrong in foreign adventures, from wars in Afghanistan to special operations around the world. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Hello, just dropping in to remind you about Here and Now. We cover the day's most essential news with context so you know the why and what's next. A fast-paced snapshot of the world every day. Listen to Here and Now on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. We're hearing the story of an unusual man, Edward Lansdale, how he succeeded and how he failed in Vietnam, the Philippines, and more. Max Boot is my guest. He's the author of The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Experience in Vietnam. I want to bring this discussion, Max, up to the present a little bit by playing this clip. This is General David Petraeus at the World Affairs Council in Connecticut in 2009, reflecting on the success of the troop surge in the Iraq War under his command.
The fact is that we did something almost miraculous logistically in Iraq. We pushed 6,000 additional U.S. forces into that country in each of about 5 months or so. It's an extraordinary effort. There's no country in the world that could probably even do that for 1 month, much less continue it for four more. And that did provide us the additional forces that were so important there.
Now, Max, David Petraeus has been described as the modern-day wise man about counterinsurgency. Are his theories and approaches substantially similar to those of Ed Lansdale? And did we discover in Iraq that they worked or they didn't work?
There is a lot of overlap between the thinking of General Petraeus and the thinking of Ed Lansdale. And in fact, I did a program with General Petraeus recently talking about this book where he said that Lansdale had some influence on him. And he was certainly aware of Lansdale. And he was thinking in a very similar mindset in terms of the importance not just of military action, but of political action and governance and winning over the people. And in fact, a lot of the success of the surge in Iraq had to do with winning over these Sunni tribes and getting Prime Minister Maliki, the Shiite sectarian, to reach out to them. So it wasn't just purely military operation. There were a lot of Lansdalean precepts that were being implemented. But, you know, sadly, if you look at the long history of American counterinsurgency, whether in Iraq or Afghanistan or elsewhere, we only implement those ideas very episodically, and then we kind of move away from them. And even in the case of Iraq, we became very complacent and took our eye off the ball, stopped trying to push Maliki in a good direction, eventually pulled our troops out, and all the success of the surge was quickly undone. And in some ways, it kind of reminded me of what happened in Vietnam after Ed Lansdale left in 1956, where we didn't replace him with anybody else who could exercise positive influence over Ngo Dinh Diem. And so Diem drifted off in a more autocratic direction, which essentially created an insurgency. And the same thing happened in Iraq with Maliki, who essentially, with his abusive behavior, created ISIS. So this is, you know, an example of how too often, even if we understand conceptually the lessons of history, we fail to implement them.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Anna on the line from Kettering, Ohio. Anna, welcome to On Point.
Good morning. You know, it sounds like a fascinating book, a what-if book. But I'm wondering if Max Boot is inferring at all that we use these kind of methods, Lansdale's proposed methods, in Iraq in any way. I'm 65. I have lots of Vietnam friends. I've talked to them in detail about their experiences. I spent a lot of time out at the Dayton, Ohio VA with my World War II vet, talking with lots of, I'm about taking him out there to the doctors, but talking to lots of Iraq and of Afghani vets. And, you know, most of them, just like in the winter hearings, will actually talk about some of the horrific things that they did and saw. And so, you know, I talked to one young man and interviewed him on WOUB Athens, Ohio. And, you know, he was kicking in doors in Iraq within the first 2 months, you know, terrorizing Iraqi families. So are you inferring that any of these methods got used? We know that General Gardner was dismissed almost immediately, and he said keep the Iraqi troops or the Iraqi soldiers in gear, and Gardner or Bremer came in and dismissed them. And I also want to mention Max. You know, you talked about McNamara selling a bill of goods to the American public. Max, you were part of the team who pushed and promoted that invasion of Iraq. Were you pushing for Lansdale's methods to be used?
Anna, thanks so much for your call. Max, what do you say?
I actually was pushing for Lansdale's methods to be used, and sadly, a lot of that advice was ignored because the history of American counterinsurgency is generally that we learn how to do it the right way at great cost, and then we forget how to do it the right way. Lansdale pioneered a lot of these soft power approaches in the Philippines in the early 50s and took them to Vietnam. And then, of course, we moved away from that and tried to win the war through firepower in the 60s, and that failed. And so when we got into Iraq in 2003, the U.S. military had by and large forgotten the lessons of counterinsurgency from an earlier era. And they thought once again that with massive use of force, they could defeat this growing insurgency. And that, of course, turned into the fiasco that was Iraq between 2003 and 2007. The situation turned around, at least temporarily, in 2007, 2008, with violence falling about 85-90%, because, in fact, General Petraeus rediscovered a lot of these precepts of classic counterinsurgency, which essentially holds that you should not use too much force. You should be very sparing in your application of firepower, because if you kill innocent people, you are creating more enemies than you eliminate. A very basic, simple, powerful insight that the U.S. military had lost sight of, and, you know, recognized once again when General Petraeus went there and had a lot of success. But it's very easy for us to drift away from what actually works in terms and go back to what we're good at, which is basically the application of firepower.
Max, what about the relevance for, say, Afghanistan or even Syria?
Well, I think it's the same story in all those battlefields. And, you know, the sobering thing, John, when you think about it, is that the U.S. military has probably killed hundreds of thousands of Islamist fighters since 9/11, but there are probably now today in the world more armed Islamist fighters than there were in 2001. And so we are having some tactical success, but we are not having long-term strategic success. And why is that? I would argue because all these countries, whether it's Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Somalia, go down the list, all these countries are a mess. They don't have stable, legitimate governments that can win the support of their people and keep order on their own. And so as a result of that, we may kill some insurgents, but then they're replaced almost instantly, and these terrorist groups become even more powerful. And so I think we've lost sight of that Lansdale insight that the only way you win these wars in the long term is by focusing on governance, on politics, on supporting stable and legitimate governments, that you're not going to kill your way out of these insurgencies.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Jim on the line from Charlotte, North Carolina. Jim, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. Hi, Max. Love the discussion. My question is the ultimate counterinsurgency against Lansdowne, and that is the growing lobbying power of the military-industrial complex of the 1950s. What role do you think that played in undermining Lansdowne's credibility within Washington power circles?
Max?
I think the defense industry was certainly part of the Iron Triangle in Washington, along with Congress people on the Hill who represented a lot of districts with military bases and defense plants. And of course, the Army itself, the military, had a relentlessly conventional mindset, because remember, this was right after the great American victory in World War II and then the also conventional Korean War. And so pretty much all the senior military leaders who were sent to Vietnam in the 50s and 60s, their background was in World War II, was in conventional conflict. And so they were habituated to think that firepower would be the solution to every problem. And this is why Ed Lansdale clashed with all of these conventional generals, because he said, you don't understand people's war. You don't understand the messy reality of this insurgency going on in Southeast Asia, and they ignored him because they thought they knew what they were doing. They defeated the German army, so why couldn't they defeat the Viet Cong? And Ed Lansdale understood that it was actually a very different and in many ways more difficult proposition.
Max, I want to again bring it to the present day. There's a story crossing the wires this morning from the New York Times in which Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, says that U.S. troops will remain in Syria after the fight against the Islamic State is over. The New York Times says it's the first time a senior Trump administration official has pledged to keep American troops in Syria well after current battles end. Does that sound to you like a reasonable proposition, a workable proposition?
Well, it depends on what those U.S. troops are going to be doing. I mean, if they're just going to be engaged in hunting down remnants of ISIS or those kinds of operations, I think the usefulness will be very limited. I think what we really need to be doing in Syria is trying to foster some kind of governmental institutions in the areas liberated from ISIS that can stand on their own, that can control their territory, win the support of their people, administer the lands liberated from ISIS in a reasonably effective way. Because if we don't do that, if you just have sheer chaos breaking out, as you did in Libya, for example, after Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown, or if all that territory is simply seized by Bashar Assad with the help of the Iranians and the Russians, and then he imposes this kind of tyrannical Alawite minority dictatorship once again, if any of these other paths come to pass, then I think you will see ISIS 2.0 arising very quickly, because Sunnis will be aggrieved and they will take up arms once again to fight for what they see as their rights. And so I think the U.S. has a vital role in trying to broker a more stable and peaceful arrangement in Syria, but it's going to be very, very hard to do.
Let's go back to the phones. Alfred's on the line from Salem, Massachusetts. Alfred, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, John, and thank you for taking my call. My question is this. The U.S. military has periodically investigated rational choice-based counterinsurgency, we're moving farther and farther away from traditional interstate conflicts, and that is how it appears to be. If I might ask your guest, what is the principal barrier to counterinsurgency being institutionalized? And I will take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks much, Alfred, for your call. Max?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, this is the struggle that Ed Lansdale fought in the 50s and 60s, because he had these insights about how to fight counterinsurgency, but ultimately they were rejected by the military establishment and by the political establishment. And today, I think it's still a struggle. There's still a lot of people who think that with our drone strikes and other air raids that we can kill these insurgents faster than they can be replaced, and that's simply not the case. So the question the caller raises is, why are we so resistant to these insights? And I think it's because counterinsurgency done right is a very difficult long-term business that doesn't promise immediate short-term gratification. And that's what everybody in the military, everybody in government, they want things that brief well. They want PowerPoint slides that show metrics of progress. And if you're taking territory, if you're killing insurgents, you're showing progress. But it's very hard to show progress if all you're doing is cultivating local people, winning their trust, working with them, learning about the local society. These were the things that Ed Lansdale did, and it doesn't brief well. It's hard to present on a PowerPoint slide, but ultimately it's going to be more effective.
It sounds like the military equivalent of a policy discussion about things that pull well rather than things that may be most beneficial in the long run.
Exactly.
I want to go back to the phones. We've got Jim on the line from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead. Jim?
Yes.
Go right ahead.
I know Lansdale was involved in an attempt to overthrow Castro in Cuba, and that seems to be very counterproductive to other things that he tried to do in his life. I was wondering what you thought about that. Thanks.
Max? Thanks, Jim.
The caller is absolutely right, and I have a whole chapter in my book on Lansdale's involvement as director of Operation Mongoose, which was the Kennedy administration effort in 1962 to overthrow Castro. And that was actually very detrimental long-term to Lansdale's career because, the Kennedys had this tremendous faith in him. They thought of him as the American James Bond, as the T. Lawrence of Asia, and they thought that he could somehow overthrow Castro without having to involve American forces in combat. Well, of course, there was no kind of covert action gimmick that could get rid of Castro in short order. And Lansdale's failure to get rid of the Kennedys' enemy, Fidel Castro, resulted in his being sidelined in the Kennedy administration as the crisis with South Vietnam was reaching its head in 1963. So it had tragic consequences on the other side of the world. And in hindsight, Lansdale said, you know, he was deeply sorry that he ever became involved in this Cuba operation because it hindered his ability to be effective in Vietnam.
Max, in the 2 minutes we have remaining, talk about the last chapter of Ed Lansdale's life after Vietnam.
Well, it was a bittersweet retirement for him because he was really kicking himself. He was very dejected because he saw that we had lost the war, and he was plagued by the question of what if people had listened to me. So he had a lot of sadness, but not a lot of surprise when he saw the collapse of South Vietnam and because of the North Vietnamese invasion in 1975. But he did have, there was one happy coda to his life because the great love of his life was this Filipino woman named Pat Kelly, whom he had met in 1945 and who became his mistress for many years. Then eventually his first wife died, and Pat Kelly had not remarried. She was retired from the U.S. Embassy in Manila, and she came out to the United States. And on July 4th of 1973, Pat Kelly and Ed Lansdale married, and then they lived happily ever after until Ed's own death from natural causes in 1987. And this is actually, to me, one of the most surprising and moving parts of the Ed Lansdale story, which has never been told before, this secret romance with this extraordinary, spunky, independent, intelligent Filipina, Pat Kelly, who really taught him a lot about the Philippines and was very important to him professionally as well as personally.
And so, something that tied together his first professional success with something he loved in his personal life.
Exactly. Pat Kelly really served as his entree into Filipino culture, and that in turn set up his great success in defeating the Hook insurgency, the communist rebellion in the Philippines in the early 1950s. And he at least got some personal satisfaction out of being united at long last with his long-lost lover.
How long did he stay in government or speaking or involved in public policy after Vietnam? Quickly.
He went into retirement after the Tet Offensive and never served in government again. He was very dejected and disillusioned.
Max Boot is Senior Fellow for National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of The Road Not Taken, Edward Lansdale and the American Experience in Vietnam. Max, it's been a fascinating hour. Thanks so much and best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really enjoyed the discussion.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, a resurgence of astrology among young people. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.